Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Constitutionally, North Carolina's government is set up to give the most power to the legislative branch. That dates all the way back to 1776 and continued in subsequent constitutions. But with the arrival of the Republican majority in the General Assembly in recent history, the power of the executive branch has been steadily reduced. It isn't just the Republican-controlled legislature chipping away at the powers of Democratic governors. They've done it to Republican governors, too. In recent months, moves have been made to reduce the power of Governor Josh Stein. Legislators fast-tracked a bill removing Stein's power to appoint state elections board members, giving the power to the Republican state auditor. The bill also mandated Democratic Attorney General Jeff Jackson to pursue issues at the will of the General Assembly. There are legal questions surrounding these and other moves, and we look at those this hour. Brian Anderson is here. He's a freelance journalist and founder of Anderson Alert Substack newsletter, which covers North Carolina politics. Colin Campbell is back with us. He's Capitol Bureau Chief and political reporter for WUNC in Chapel Hill in Durham. And Dr. Chris Cooper is director of the Hare Institute for Public Policy at Western Carolina University and author of the book Anatomy of a Purple State, a North Carolina Politics Primer. Good morning, everybody. Welcome back.
Great to be here.
Thanks for having us.
You're welcome. Chris, I want to begin with a little history lesson here, because I suppose it could be argued that today the governor actually has more power than historically he or she has had, because in the 90s, our state was the last state in the nation to give the governor veto power. Republicans had just taken control of the House, but the governor at the time, Jim Hunt, was a Democrat. So just fill me in. Why? Why would they give that power to him at that time?
You know, it was a long time coming, right? So if you go back and read the old newspaper accounts, people have been talking about giving the governor the veto power in North Carolina since really the 1930s. And every session you'd have the governor, of course, saying, give me more power, and the General Assembly saying, nah, I think we're good. We finally had every one of the living governors getting together saying over and over and over, please, please, please give us the veto power. It was, like you said, the very last state in the country to give the governor the veto power about 100 years after every other state. And the person who was the primary sponsor on the bill who eventually gave the governor veto power in North Carolina was a junior state senator from Nash County named Roy Cooper. So, there's all sorts of stories there about exactly how that veto came about and exactly what power it gives. But I think we should note, sort of in close here, that yes, we finally gave the governor the veto power, but we're one of only five states in the country that doesn't give the governor that line item veto power they have everywhere else in the country.
What are the pros and cons, as a political scientist, what are the pros and cons of either having a strong governor's office and a weaker legislature, or vice versa, a strong legislature and a weak governor's office? Are there pros and cons to both?
Yeah, absolutely. There's pros and cons to both, right? I mean, we're talking ultimately about one person. And so I think the cons are pretty clear, right? How much power do you want to give to one person, whether that's a Democrat or Republican or, I don't know, some Green Party person, a Libertarian one day miraculously got in there? Do you want to give that much power to one person? On the other hand, we have a system here in North Carolina where we give the legislature not just more power, but the overwhelming amount of power. So let's take redistricting, for example. Our governor, unlike the vast majority of states, doesn't have any veto power over redistricting. So our General Assembly members can pass essentially any map they want to. They don't have to worry about getting the supermajority threshold. They can just pass it. As long as it gets through the courts, that becomes law. So just thought experiment for a second. Imagine how much less litigation we'd have in the state of North Carolina if the governor had the ability to veto those maps. I think we'd have a very, very different situation on our hands. And let's remember, too, that this General Assembly, this legislature we're giving so much power to, we're paying them a whopping $13,951 a year. So what we're saying is, y'all have all the power. We're not really going to give you any resources.
Yeah. legislators are elected by district. I think the governor is one of the few offices in North Carolina that are elected by all the voters. There are others, but the governor is the top dog in terms of that. So just from a democracy point of view, why wouldn't you want the person that everybody votes for, whether they vote for that person or the other candidate, to have more power than people from tiny little counties scattered all over the state?
Well, as a resident of one of the tiny little counties in the far western part of the state, I'll say there, it's the idea of one person rule, right? I mean, we're as we think about the federal constitution and the way it was set up and in our founding, right? If you know nothing else about U.S. history, the one thing you know is we didn't love kings, right? We weren't real fond of one person having a whole lot of power. And so I think the idea is we want to translate that same idea to the state, to our state government, our state constitution, and we don't want to give that person too much power. We do have, as you said, the governor who's elected statewide. We also have 9 other council of state members. And so when we talk about how our governor's so weak, there's a lot of reasons why. But one is you take that executive power, and where in most states you might have 1 or maybe 2 or perhaps 3 other council of state, statewide elected folks to distribute that power to. We have 9 others in our state. That is a huge number. That is a large council of state. Another way in which we say, let's diffuse the executive power that does exist.
So, Brian, you've been covering North Carolina legislature and politics for a long time, and the governor is, as I said, constitutionally weak, but in recent years they've been making, right up to last week, they've been doing things to make the governor even weaker. How long has, to quote the old song, how long has this been going on, this attempt to weaken the governor?
I mean, paraphrase, Disney tales old as time, right? I mean, this has been a trend going on for a long, long time, and what's happened in recent years is nothing new. The latest action was, Republicans lose their supermajority as a result of the 2024 elections. They come back in December the next month, and with their outgoing supermajority, enact a sweeping 132-plus page law that basically the highlights are it strips power away from incoming statewide Democrats like the AG Jeff Jackson, Lieutenant Governor Hunt, Governor-elect Josh Stein. So this is a long effort by not just Republicans, but lawmakers in general to take power away from the executive. You hear the phrase, you want co-equal branches of government federally. Like North Carolina, there's nothing co-equal about this state. Like the legislature is the branch that reigns supreme and is reined in from time to time by the judiciary. And now the governor is one of the least powerful offices in the country compared to other governors. And, we talked to Robert Reeves yesterday and he joked, Stein might have wanted to run for auditor had he known all the powers the auditor was going to have. So this follows a trend that's been happening for quite some time.
So, Colin, the governor may be weak constitutionally and be made weaker by the legislature over time, but it seems like we still have strongmen because we still have the Senate Majority Leader and the Speaker of the House. It's 2 tough guys as opposed to just 1. Is that how it was intended to be?
I think when the legislature was originally envisioned, the thought was that it was more diffused power, that, everybody represents a certain number of counties, a certain number of voters, and they have equally similar powers. In practice, that has not been the case, and increasingly power in the legislature is consolidated among leadership. So the folks who elect House Speaker Dustin Hall or Senate Leader Phil Berger inherently have a lot more power than someone who is electing a Democrat or even a rank and file Republican in another part of the state, because those folks just don't have the same level of control over what legislation moves, what sort of policies get enacted, what are the priorities going to be. So that's sort of it's this tension around, if you talk to legislators, they'll say, we're closer to the people. We're the people you see in the grocery store on the weekend. And that's why we should have more power than the governor who's sitting in a mansion in Raleigh. But in reality, it's only a few of those legislators who are actually calling the shots. And that's one of the big concerns for folks who live in areas that are very different from the areas that, Dustin Hall from Lenore or Phil Berger from Eden up by the Virginia border, very small towns, rural areas represent.
Go ahead, Brian.
And just one thing bouncing off of something Chris had said, you know, we panelists, we like to travel throughout the state as well. And I had a little nugget from one of my travels. You know, if you go to the coast, you see Caswell Beach. That's named after the first governor of this state. If you go to Tryon Palace there, or Tryon Palace, there's a little nugget of history where, you know, the governor from sort of the British era, he was kind of thrown out and had to flee that area in 1775. So as we got the U.S. Constitution in 76, you know, there's this mindset among North Carolinians that this all-powerful governor is someone who is a foreign actor, an enemy of we the people. And so that was really this kind of back burner mindset as we're creating our U.S. Constitution, as our state constitutions then being crafted down the line. We really have distrust in just one person having so much power. And, you know, Mike, as you alluded to, it's not one person having all this power. Now it's really like two people having so much power.
So in 1776, when we wrote the first constitution for the state of North Carolina, one of the delegates to that constitution said the document gave the governor just enough power to sign the receipt for his own salary. Subsequent constitutions have maintained that the status quo on that, and then we have moves within the legislature, Chris, over recent years to weaken that power further. So what powers does the governor have?
You know, fewer than they used to, right? So appointment power is one of the big ones. We have seen the number of appointments that our governor enjoys go down over time. That did happen when the Democrats were in charge of the General Assembly and they had Republican governors as well, but that's certainly gone down over the last few years. The key one, I think the newsy one that Colin and Brian have been covering so well, is appointment power over the North Carolina State Board of Elections, right? So the governor has had this power since 1901, and now it looks like the auditor has the power for the first time in North Carolina history, and as far as I can tell, the first time in United States history. So some of that appointment power has declined. The power of the veto is real. That does matter. Another way we think about gubernatorial power is power over the budget. But unfortunately for the North Carolina governor, not a lot of power there, right? The governor goes first in this budget game every cycle. But as one legislator told me years ago, the governor's budget is very, very powerful. After all, where else can you find a doorstop that effective in Raleigh when you need one, right? In other words, it just doesn't matter. So in really most of the major ways we talk about gubernatorial power, they're lacking here. The ceremonial power, though, is where I think it really matters, right? So for your average North Carolinian, my guess is they can identify Josh Stein, Roy Cooper, much before they can identify Phil Berger. Berger may be the one with the real power in Destin Hall, but I think in the mind of the average voter, it is the governor, even if the formal powers don't align.
And there is power in that, one presumes. Republican legislatures haven't just gone after Democratic governors, Colin. They've gone after Republican governors and tried to minimize their power as well, including our own beloved Pat McCrory. Why would they do that?
Yeah, they sort of view the legislature as the branch that ought to have the power, whether the person in the governor's mansion is a Republican or a Democrat. Part of that was they never really got along with Pat McCrory. He came from sort of the urban landscape of being Charlotte's mayor. He didn't necessarily have the same relationships with some of the Republican politicians in the legislature that maybe a different GOP candidate might have had. But certainly some of these efforts to strip powers from the governor, as you mentioned, took place when McCrory was governor in the last decade. McCrory was one who was actively suing the legislature. There's been lawsuits that were labeled McCrory v. Berger, trying to get some of those powers back and make the case that the Constitution made the governor's office more powerful than the legislature wanted it to be.
How many were successful?
They've been a little bit successful. They've had a few successes, but the legislature has tried different ways, and that's kind of where we're at right now.
We have to take a break. We're going to come back and take a closer look at some of these moves against the governor's office in a moment at Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the weak governor's office, constitutionally weak governor's office, made weaker by moves in the General Assembly in recent years. On Charlotte Talks this morning, Dr. Chris Cooper is with us. He's the director of the Hare Institute of Public Policy at Western Carolina University. Colin Campbell is Capitol Bureau Chief for WUNC, and Brian Anderson is with us. He's the author of the Anderson Substack. Brian, late last year, there was an attempt by legislators to strip the governor's office of the power to fill court vacancies and name members of a commission that regulates companies that offer electricity, gas, and other services. In February, Governor Stein filed suit against House Speaker Destin Hall and Senate Leader Phil Berger to strike down provisions of that bill. Where does that stand?
So right now, North Carolina has favorable state-level courts for conservatives. And so there's been efforts in the past to strip the governor of appointment powers in various ways. And right now, when it comes to the State Board of Elections, Republicans have gone about it in a different way. What they previously did was say, let's take power away from the governor and give it to us legislators. Now what they're doing for the State Board of Elections is saying, let's strip the governor of his power and give it to fellow Council of State member, which is also an executive office, hoping that, you know, this doesn't really violate some of these separation of powers concerns of the past. And as things stand right now, the Court of Appeals, a panel, has said, you know, we're going to give the thumbs up for Republicans to have a conservative majority on the State Board of Elections. Now, that went into place with members being sworn in just last week. We're going to have a new executive director tomorrow, and that person is the general counsel to House Speaker Destin Hall. So there's some harmony, if you will, that will be there between the legislature and the State Board of Elections that wasn't there before, but it's still going through the court process. That's where the State Board of Elections fight really stands. And why this matters is because it will have impact on, you know, how people can vote in 2026 and even these municipal elections perhaps coming up. And it will have an impact on, you know, the state Supreme Court race. There's still a court, there's still court precedent that has been set and room for the State Board of Elections to interpret things. And when you have a conservative majority, the fear Democrats who I've spoken to have is that that's going to result in people being wrongfully tossed off the voter rolls.
Chris, when Democrats were in power, and they were in power for a very long time, did they do similar things?
Yeah, absolutely. They did similar things. So if we sort of go back in history, 1972 is the first Republican governor in modern times. And what did the Democrats do right when we got a Republican governor? They decided to strip some power from the governor. Then we get Jim Hunt, who comes in right after that, Democrat. And so what happens at that point? We get a Democrat again. The Democrat, Jim Hunt, fired so many people, they called it the Christmas Massacre. Right? So then 84, we get another Republican, Jim Martin. He comes in the governor's office. And so what do the Democrats do? They say, you know what? We need to change a little bit about the State Board of Elections. It's going to sound pretty familiar. They say up to that point, that was the governor could appoint essentially anybody they wanted. After 1985, they said, you know what? Maybe you should be limited, governor, by the names the party submits. Sounds a lot like something we just saw in the General Assembly, actually on an unrelated piece of legislation just yesterday. So this happened when Democrats were in charge. It happens when Republicans were in charge. This is a people in power wanting to keep power problem, not one unique to one party or the other.
And are we unique, or does this happen frequently in other states?
Yeah, we are unique in some ways, and it's sort of the irony of being a purple state, right? So if you are, let's say, Oklahoma, right? The Republicans control everything in Oklahoma. So there is absolutely no need to like move power from one branch to the other, like from one Republican to the other. Who cares, right? Or if you're in a very, very Democratic state, like why would they move it from one branch to the other, from one Democrat to the other? What you see in purple states like North Carolina, we see very similar things in Wisconsin, is when you get power, you might lose it soon. And so there is an advantage in making these kinds of changes. So what makes us purple and competitive is the same kind of thing that leads to this dizzying back and forth of power grabs, frankly.
And so many states have a two-thirds veto override threshold. North Carolina's is three-fifths. So that is why it's a little bit easier also, if you're the legislature, to override any objections that a governor may have. So that's also a little a little quirk. And I asked Roy Cooper at the time, you know, because he played a role in crafting what became this legislation. You know, what were you thinking at the time? And how do you feel that you kind of restricted yourself when you would go on to be governor? And the response I got back from their office was basically, you know, this was the compromise that was best that they could get at the time. Like, there were Democrats like Dan Blue who did not want the governor to have a veto whatsoever, really. And so North Carolina is unique for a number of reasons, but also because it's a 3/5 threshold, not a 2/3.
So at the time of this most recent attempt to limit the governor's power, Colin, Governor Stein characterized the legislation as a, quote, partisan power grab that thwarts North Carolina's decisions at the ballot box. And he pointed out that he won the governor's office with a comfortable majority, which signals that the public wants him to retain powers. So two questions. Can this be described as anything other than a partisan power grab, one in a series, actually? And can it be successfully argued that Stein's comfortable margin of victory over Mark Robinson last November is a signal that voters wanted him to have power, more power?
You know, I think the people certainly wanted him to have the power that the governor had at the time. Whether the average voter understands the full scope or lack of scope of the governor's powers, I think is probably questionable. I don't think people necessarily realize what powers he does have, what powers he doesn't have. Most people probably don't realize exactly how the State Board of Elections is constructed. Republicans would argue that having one party, the Democrats having majority on that board was unfair, led to partisan decisions. They'll point out that in the past, they tried to restructure that in a way that there was a additional unaffiliated voter who served as sort of the tiebreaker on that board, and you had a more equal number of Republicans and Democrats. As a result of this change, we're pretty much switching the partisan nature of the State Board of Elections, at putting it under the state auditor, who most people, when they went to vote for state auditor last year, were not thinking about elections administration. They were thinking about who they wanted to be sort of the taxpayer watchdog looking into misspent funds around state government. And now that person is going to be overseeing elections. So I think a lot of people would argue, we didn't really vote for the auditor to be the elections guy, and now he's the elections guy. And now you have a similarly partisan State Board of Elections. It's just flipped. It's now on the Republican side and under the state auditor, under this interesting argument that we alluded to earlier, that now the executive branch includes these other statewide elected offices and not just the governor. That seems to be something that Republicans on the court seem to be okay with that interpretation, but it'll be interesting to see how it plays out in the long run. If Republicans hadn't won state auditor, I don't know that they would have given that power of elections to the state auditor. Would they have given it to the agriculture commissioner or somebody else? And if that office flips to Democrats in the next election, will they move it around again? I mean, there's a lot of interesting questions around parceling out these duties that had been the governor to these other statewide elected offices that, at least in theory, are more narrow in scope of what their job actually is supposed to be.
So the result of this, Chris, is that the governor sues the legislature or the Speaker of the House or the head of the Senate to try to get these powers back. And recently, I believe, he sought to have declared unconstitutional the law that places conditions on whom he can appoint to fill vacancies on the 7-member Supreme Court and the 15-member intermediate level Court of Appeals. Why does he say that removing that power from the governor is unconstitutional? What does the Constitution have to say about that?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is a great question. So I think he would argue that essentially he is left almost without any sort of executive power, gubernatorial power, if he is stripped of the appointment power that you just talked about, right? So it's less about the letter of the Constitution, right? The Constitution doesn't say the governor gets appointment power over the following 312 people. It just says he gets appointment power. And so he's trying to argue, hey, look, the spirit of this document, which the last one we had was in 1970, is pretty clear that the governor should have power over these appointments. He says, let's look at the way the government was structured at the time, the power that the governor had at the time. I should have roughly that amount of power as well. And that essentially, what can I do if I can't do these basic, he would call, executive functions?
Let's talk a little bit about this Board of Elections brouhaha that's going on and the shuffling that occurred, I think, just last week. This latest move to take the power of appointing members of the state election board away from the governor and give it to the state auditor, who just happens to be a Republican. A couple of years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court decided against the state legislature in a case called Moore v. Harper, which aimed for the high court to recognize independent state legislature theory. I thought we were done talking about that, but clearly not. Had they done so, the legislature would have had total control over elections. The Supreme Court decided against the legislature in that case. So, Brian, has the General Assembly now done an end run around that decision?
I mean, Democrats would say so. I mean, you've taken what was, the lesson learned from that lawsuit for Republicans wasn't, oh, we can't do this. The lesson learned was maybe we should do the same thing, but in a different way, and we'll have Bullock be our force for good, if you will. So that seems to be the takeaway from that experience. I think, you know, remember back in 2016, to take a time travel back, the big talk was HB2. HB2 was the big bill in 2016. But what's less talked about is SB4. And Senate Bill 4, what that did was that shifted powers away from the governor to the legislature, including this effort on state board of elections as well. And when the day I turned 21, McCrory signed that bill into law, and therefore it didn't have an override vote. Who was the lead architect of that? Bob Rucho, State Senator Bob Rucho, who is now a member of the State Board of Elections thanks to this conservative control? Bob Rucho. So you have someone who has consistently in the past tried to entrench the GOP's power on the State Board of Elections, now playing a big role in helping run the State Board of Elections. And Francis DeLuca, the chairman of the State Board of Elections, he is someone who authored a bill that courts had said targeted Black people with almost surgical precision. Mm-hmm. DeLuca has taken credit for his role in crafting a bill that got struck down. So these are now the people who are overseeing state elections in North Carolina. So it's just kind of worth noting how full circle this has really become.
This transfer of power on the State Board of Elections, Chris, happened last week, and many people think it's over. It's not over. The governor is still fighting this. Just weeks ago, a state court ruled that the law transferring power on that board to the state auditor was unconstitutional because it violates the state's constitution's separation of powers. But the appeals court allowed the law to take effect while it works its way further up the chain. So what happens and what is likely to happen next, Chris?
I'm really hoping you weren't going to ask me that question. I thought it's going to go a lot of different ways. I hope Mike's not going to ask me how exactly that would work. Right?
What would you like me to ask you?
Chris, why are you so awesome? That's the hard questions.
Are we talking about Mike? And no. It's raised the very same question to me. So let's say that a court comes in and says, you know what, this is wrong. This does violate separation of powers. Are we just going to go back and do another appointment from Stein? Like it, and then does Karen Brinson Bell get her job back? And do we then fire the current recently appointed director? I don't really understand exactly what that would look like. I understood very clearly what that was going to look like before the installation happened, but now that it has, I think we're all flying by the seat of our pants and trying to figure it out as well.
And I think it's fairly unlikely that we see the Supreme Court jump in there and overturn the Court of Appeals' initial decision on this. I think that's part of why this was allowed to go into effect, is the pattern we've seen, given the partisan makeup of our courts right now, is these sort of lawsuits over executive powers. First, they go to a judge in Wake County, just the way the statute's set up. Wake County, of course, blue county, full of left-leaning judges. Then it goes to the Court of Appeals, full of Republican judges. They tend to side with the legislature. And now it goes to the state Supreme Court, also full of Republican judges who tend to side with the legislature. So I think, if I were a betting person, I would probably bet on this particular balance of power being allowed to stay in place by the courts. But then again, you never know. It is North Carolina, and there's always surprises around every corner.
Which is actually the answer I thought Chris was going to give us, but he took a different direction. Republicans say, Colin, that the governor has too much power, too much control over elections, resulting in one-party decision-making and a lack of voter confidence. Democrats say that this is a GOP power grab designed to give Republicans an unfair advantage in elections in a battleground state. Given all the moves by the General Assembly that they've made in recent years to weaken the governor's office and to surgically draw voting districts in a way that only benefits their party at the
expense.
Expense, thank you. I don't like expenses. At the expense of Democrats. Can that claim about one party decision making be taken seriously? They're doing all the
right. If they'd gone for a system where you had, you know, more impartial referees overseeing elections, I don't know, maybe you put the libertarians or the unaffiliated voters in some sort of role of power on this. But it really, I mean, if you look at both the partisan makeup of the elections board now and who's on it and who's administering elections. I mean, we have, I think for the first time in decades, the new executive director, Sam Hayes, who was general counsel to the House Speaker, has a lot of experience in state government, no experience with elections administration. I looked back the last time Republicans had a majority on the elections board, which was under Pat McCrory when he was governor. They immediately elevated Kim Strack, who was a longtime elections board staffer and administrator, to the top role. And she had a pretty strong reputation as being nonpartisan. I think it will be harder for Sam Hayes and whoever he brings in to have the same reputation, just knowing that he's coming from such a political background of working for some of the top legislative leaders.
So, Chris, given that Collins says this is going to stand because the Supreme Court leans to the right, does that give Republicans an unfair advantage going forward? And what difference does the makeup of the elections board have on our elections?
You know, I think fairness is obviously in the eye of the beholder, but it's a fundamental change. And I think, and we'll get to the question of what it matters and what that board does in a second, but let's think about this too. I think, I can't remember if it was Colin or Brian, but somebody had mentioned just the increasing power of the auditor in general, what this is going to mean in 2028. I mean, the auditor is going to go from being the sleepiest among the sleepiest elections in North Carolina to being just positively lit. I mean, the amount of money we're going to see in this auditor's race in 2028 is going to be just astronomical. So why? Like, why does it matter so much? Part of it is the thing that hasn't happened yet, right? There's going to be a trickle down. We have 100 county boards of elections. All 100 of those counties are now also going to flip to Republican control. So it's not just the state board, it's 101 boards that are going to make this move. So on the ground, where is your early voting location? Sort of think about that in your head. That might change coming forward with a new board.
That and more. And if you think they're done, they're not. There are more reductions in power that we can talk about when we come back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the disappearing gubernatorial power, vanishing power, that's happened over time and continues now with Dr. Chris Cooper, who's the director of the Hare Institute of Public Policy at Western Carolina University. Colin Campbell is Capitol Bureau Chief for WUNC, and Brian Anderson is the author of the Anderson Substack, which has become kind of a go-to way of finding out what's going on in the legislature. Chris, state auditor, this put a smile on my face when I read it. State Auditor Bolick has made the argument that it makes sense for his office to handle elections because it's about counting votes. Any comment on that?
It is about counting votes, yes, and it's about a whole lot of other things as well, right? So, I mean, let's go back to right before the break. We talked about placement of early voting sites, right? That even may seem pretty simple, but it's incredibly important. So what parts of town get represented? How far does the average person have to travel before they can cast that vote? How much does it cost to rent these spaces? Are these spaces ADA compliant? How are they dealing with campaign finance, which is another thing that the State Board of Election deals with? What types of voting equipment get certified by the state? Election administration is incredibly complicated. This is no longer just the local clerk who is counting ballots. There's a heck of a lot more to it than that. And I think the number of Charlotte talk shows that I've been on and others talking about election administration just reveals how complicated and political this job is.
Yeah. One thing I would add on that is one of the biggest touch points we see on election board battles, both at the state and at the county level, is over Sunday voting hours. Republicans don't like to see early voting locations open on Sundays. They think that, you know, perhaps should be a day of rest for the people who run elections. But what that's largely about is who votes on Sundays. A lot of African-American churches do what they call souls to the polls, where they go out after the church service and go all vote together at a early voting site. And so when you take away Sunday voting, that tends to have an impact on who's voting, particularly among Black voters. And so you see a big partisan battle over those types of things like early voting hours. It would seem to be a nonpartisan issue. It's actually a very partisan issue.
Which leads me to my next question, because the Republican Party has been being very loud about their fears of voter integrity and voter confidence in our elections, and yet they do things like that. And if they are truly concerned, Chris, about voter confidence in our elections, would they have allowed Jefferson Griffin to spend 6 months trying to challenge votes that were legally cast by changing the rules after the vote was done to make that illegal? Would they have taken those moves?
You know, I think it depends who you mean by they, right? I mean, ultimately, who was bringing these claims up? It wasn't the General Assembly, right? It wasn't the state board, really. This was Jefferson Griffin and his team. I think to some degree, the state Republican Party, and then obviously some courts that allowed this to continue. But I think your overarching point that you're implying is correct, right? This recent, whatever you want to call it, between Jefferson Griffin and Allison Riggs and the board is going to hurt, not help, claims about, you know, kind of how people trust elections, how much faith people have in elections, and how much faith they have that their vote is counted accurately and fairly.
And if you don't believe in the integrity of the elections, are you likely to vote? And could that be one of the reasons behind these moves?
You know, I don't know if that's the reason or not, or trying to not put sort of what people's motivations are, but I will say empirically, you're correct. The less trust you have in the election process, the less likely you are to cast that vote. Just makes sense, right? If I think it's a rigged game, why would I want to participate in it? If I show up to a pool hall and I know that there's somebody who's running tables, I'm probably not going to want to put my money down on that table. So the same thing is true for elections.
Not that they rig things at casinos, but the house wins at casinos and people still flock to them all the time.
Brian?
Yeah, just on the state Supreme Court race, you know, there was the swearing in ceremony just yesterday, and I actually got to speak with Justice Anita Earls, who actually played a role in the deliberations of how this case has played out. And she told me, and I'm quoting her exactly, she said, "The order that I dissented from established the principle that if you are an overseas voter who has never lived in North Carolina, you can't vote in state elections. The question is, how will the Board of Elections know who those people are? And that's an administrative question that I think hasn't been answered." That's her words. So what now happens, reading between the lines, is there's two voter rolls. There's two categories of voters. The State Board of Elections has said as much too. There's voters who can only vote in federal elections. So unless you live in the first congressional district, your vote federally doesn't matter. It does for 2026 for a U.S. Senate race. But other than first district and Senate race, your vote doesn't matter for many people. And then there's everybody else who's been able to vote in all elections, all state elections, your mayor, your governor, your judicial candidates. Those people won't have issues. And the problem that I see is after this Supreme Court ruling came out, I had a knot in my stomach at 3 a.m. where I went through all these lists of accused never residents, and I stumbled across this UNC Greensboro professor who's been here for multiple decades, has visited every single college in the state, is still a resident. I went to that voter's home. I talked to their next door neighbors who said we just had had dinner with them recently. This is clearly a resident. There's a person in Jackson County named Josiah Young who played basketball at a community college here, has a drone business in Western North Carolina. These are people who are very clearly residents who Griffin wrongly accused of never residing here. There's 30 people. What happens to them? Jury's still out.
Okay. You reported recently, Brian, that House Bill 443, which would prohibit the governor from filling GOP vacancies on the Council of State with a Democrat. Who are the members of the Council of State, first of all, and what would this mean should something become vacant?
Yeah, the recent case study is there was a labor commissioner who didn't really love being labor commissioner. At Josh, Colin, what was his last name?
Dobson.
Dobson, yeah. And so Josh Dobson had left this labor commissioner job after the election. Cooper fills it with a Democratic vacancy. And I think around that time, we learned some things about a farm with a state senator that documents may not have uncovered if there wasn't a Democrat in charge of being labor commissioner at the time. I'd have to double check on the timing of that. But essentially, there was a concern from Republicans that you can have Democrats in charge when Republicans are taking office. And we don't want that to happen if we're Republicans. So essentially, because Cooper had replaced Dobson with a Democrat, even for just a couple months, Republicans saw that as an attack on incoming Commissioner Luke Farley and didn't want such future scenarios to happen again for Council of State. So essentially, it's kind of like the argument you had said of, you know, did the voters elect Josh Stein wanting him to appoint people to the State Board of Elections? Well, did people elect Luke Farley because they wanted him to be labor commissioner? It's kind of an inconsistent logic between the two of, you know, when someone wins, that party should remain in power. That's the issue.
And yeah, and we're seeing that with other stuff as well. The judicial seats, currently the governor can pick whoever he wants, or has been historically able to pick whoever he wants when a judge leaves office early, either at the county level or at the state level. And that's how we've seen some changes on the high courts recently. And then there are other things that they're just now discovering. Like just yesterday, there was a bill to take away the governor's power to pick a new district attorney when the district attorney resigns. Well, it turns out what's happening there is in Johnston County outside of Raleigh, a Republican DA just announced her pending resignation. So there's a worry among Republicans that Stein is going to pick a Democrat to be the DA in this very conservative county. So Republicans in the legislature now want to change the law so that he would have to pick somebody that the political parties recommend for those jobs. So we're seeing that that appointment power just kind of eroding bit by bit as we go through and see these examples where Republicans don't like who the governor is picking.
So where does House Bill 443 stand at the moment, Brian?
So HB 443, just looking it up because there's always things that get calendared and updates. So essentially right now that is over in the land of purgatory of House rules. Because it's a constitutional amendment, it wasn't subject to this state crossover deadline. So it's not dead. It's still up for debate and consideration. There's other bills that would kind of limit the attorney general in his ability to intervene on Trump executive orders. There's other ideas that have been floated out that could still be considered. If you are a cynical reporter like me or Colin, maybe you think it works its way into a budget instead of a standalone bill, because that's usually the place where you kind of put these types of provisions. So it's still an active thought.
But again, this is another wrinkle in this, because, Chris, this is being proposed as a constitutional amendment, which means that the governor cannot veto it if it passes. But it has to have a 3/5 support in the House and Senate. Republicans don't have a supermajority. How likely is it that they'd be able to garner those votes in the House and Senate to pass this thing out as an amendment to the Constitution?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's about three Democrats who are going to determine the answer to that question, right? And so there's a very small number of Democrats who have, in the past broken with their own party or done what's referred to as taking a walk. They have decided to just sort of be absent when the votes are taken, so that way they're not on the record as going against their own party, but at the same time they are kind of helping this thing pass. So folks like Cecil Brockman, I think a lot of people in the state look at as being the key to figuring out exactly what is going to end up passing and what isn't. This will not come to the governor's desk at all. These constitutional amendments, redistricting, and local bills are the three big things that don't come before the governor's desk for veto.
And it isn't just the governor's office within the executive branch that the legislature has been targeting. In February, the Senate was considering a bill that would forbid the attorney general, who happens to be a Democrat, Jeff Jackson, from acting to file any action or advance any argument challenging the validity of an executive order from the President of the United States. It also prohibits the Attorney General from seeking to invalidate any act of the General Assembly. Effectively, does that prohibit him from doing his job, Brian?
I mean, yes and no. I mean, you could say, yeah, the Attorney General had this power, but really, I mean, in effect, when someone sues a Trump executive order, it's not one governor from North Carolina. It's like dozens or at least 15 states usually. So, I mean, is the fact that North Carolina's AG not being able to join those lawsuits significant? Yes. But in practice, will it matter? Maybe not.
It but is sort of the ability of the AG to insert themselves on some of these national matters, because you see these coalitions of attorneys general from different states, all Democrats, coming together to fight this or that Trump administration thing. We saw that from Jeff Jackson initially when he first took office. Now I'm seeing, even before this bill becomes law, he's a little bit more reluctant to jump in these things. So I'll see a national press release about Democratic AGs coming together to fight this, and I don't see Jeff Jackson's name on it anymore.
But it's not just his ability to challenge orders coming out of the White House. As I said, it would prohibit him from challenging anything coming out of the General Assembly. I mean, is that even constitutional?
Well, I think Republicans would argue he's required to back whatever the state's position is. So if the state passes a law, somebody sues to block the law, then the Attorney General's job, at least in the minds of some, is that he should fight on behalf of the state and support that law. Attorney General, both Stein, who had the job before, Jeff Jackson now, have said if they think something's unconstitutional, then it's their right as AG to opt not to be the person backing it, which in the past has meant that the legislature has hired its own attorneys to fight on behalf of some law that they've passed. So this is one of those sort of gray areas about exactly what does this job do and what's its responsibilities that there's a lot of disagreement over, and the legislature now jumping in basically trying to say, hey, you can't do that. Here's the parameters in which you can operate as Attorney General.
Chris, you could say that this is all just politics, but this appears to the layperson as politics on steroids. Have we ever seen anything like this, or is this something new? At least the strength of it and the rapidity of it, is it something new?
I mean, look, we talked about it at the top, I think, right? We have seen examples of, you know, changes in power, power grab, whatever you want to call it before. We saw it when the Democrats are in charge, saw it when Republicans are in charge. So it's not new, but the speed of it, I think, is fundamentally different right now. And the stakes are just so high, right? So we have 5 members of the Council of State who are Democrats, 5 members of the Council of State who are Republicans. And so we're seeing more shuffling, partly because there's more to be gained. I mean, if you go through the Helene power grab bill, as people call it, essentially every Democrat except Elaine Marshall, who appears to be in her own camp of okay with by the Republicans, has had their power stripped at least in some degree by this bill. So I think the opportunity is there, which means they're acting on it more and more and more. And what I'm curious to see, I think Colin mentioned it before, is what happens when these offices eventually flip? The governor is going to be a Republican at some point again.
Right.
Eventually, we're going to have a Republican attorney general. Eventually, a Democrat's going to win the auditor's seat. Are we just going to keep playing musical chair with power depending on who's in charge? That's a terrible way to run a state, regardless of which side you may side with.
Brian.
You'll look at some of these bills, like there's the Davification of state government for Auditor Bullock, and they want him to have oversight of some DOGE-level state type of entity. You'll notice from the bill language, there's things that expire December 31st, 2028. Why does it expire December 31st, 2028? It's because that's the last day he's in office if he loses re-election. So, I mean, there's certainly this type of carousel activity going on. The one thing I think that does need to be mentioned is SB 382 changed the timeline in which provisionals can be accepted from 9 days to 3 days. So all the ballots that went for Riggs after the election, if these new rules were in place in 2026, Riggs may very well have lost to Griffin.
So I have 45 seconds left. Chris, experts, some pundits have said that what's happening in Raleigh is part of a master plan, and other Republican-controlled states, is part of a master plan among Republicans to change the shape of our politics at all levels. But it seems that in Republican-controlled states, there are efforts to strengthen the legislative branch and weaken the executive branch, while the reverse is true in Washington. Explain that.
Yeah, I mean, power. Power, I think, is the only thing you need to know. Who has it and who wants to keep it?
But why don't Republicans in Congress want the power? Why are they ceding the power?
Because we set it up for ambition to be made to counteract ambition, according to the Federalist, and it turns out that party ambition overrides chamber and institution ambition.
Dr. Chris Cooper, director of the Hare Institute for Public Policy at Western Carolina University, Colin Campbell, Capitol Bureau Chief for WUNC, and Brian Anderson, author of The Anderson Substack. Thanks for the hour.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.